Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome one and all to Trisha's True Crime Radio. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. Last I checked, it was 7 below where I am living, if you can call it living. I'm more like bundled up in a big blanket here. So if all of a sudden I quit talking, it's because I've frozen to death. That's all there is to it. Trisha's True Crime Radio is brought to you by Canines with a Cause. Canines with a Cause, rescuing animals from death row and then teaming up those animals with returning veterans to help them adjust. Please visit their website. You will love this group. It's caninswithacause.com. Okay, before we get into the meat of the show, we're going to talk about a word. The word is dirtbag. Dirtbag. What is the definition of a dirtbag? Well, to me, a dirtbag is kind of a variant on scumbag. Both are bag types in the insult world, but a dirtbag carries with it a connotation of something really, really nasty. And speaking of Lindsay Lohan, yes, she has now officially become a dirtbag. Did you hear what she did? First, she steals stuff all the time, and she thinks she can get away with it because, after all, she's Lindsay Lohan. Well, she's done more than that. Now, she can sing and act at times, although Lindsay's latest movie on Lifetime, Liz and Dick, was more painful to watch than removing your own gallbladder with an oyster fork. But Lindsay Lohan has done more with her life because of her talent than, say, Kim, I'll do anything for publicity, Kardashian. Let's give Lindsay Lohan that credit. But it was on the set of Liz and Dick that Lohan met Liz Taylor's personal nurse. They became close. The nurse even gave Lindsay a coat that belonged to Liz. While Lohan was visiting with the nurse at the nurse's home, the nurse showed her a beautiful and very expensive bracelet that belonged to Liz. Liz fell in love with the bracelet. Lindsay fell in love with the bracelet, and Lindsay wanted the bracelet. According to reports, Lindsay took the bracelet. When the nurse discovered it was missing, she knew who the culprit was. It was a dirtbag, Lindsay Lohan. She told Lindsay to bring it back or she was calling the police. Here's where it gets good. Lohan had the nerve to tweet something along the lines of, "Liz would be so disappointed in the way you are acting." She tweeted that to the nurse. Lohan has tsunami-sized butt gall, is what I mean to say. Shortly thereafter, a minion of Lohan's returned the bracelet. Reports say that Lohan was going to have a duplicate bracelet made with fake stones and then give that one back, but apparently she thought better of it. Now, granted, I'm only basing these reports on what has been in the mainstream media this weekend, and there's always a chance it isn't true, but it sure sounds like our lovely Lindsay, doesn't it? Which brings me back to the word dirtbag. What Lohan reportedly did was such a dirtbag thing to do, I'm going to move her up from the bag category and move her to the wad category. She is officially a skankwad, and that's all there is to it. Now we're going to go on to people who really, really matter. We're going to talk about the victims in the Aurora shooting and a gentleman who we all know, we all trust, one of the few people I trust in the mainstream media, who has been front and center in the courtroom every time James Holmes has made an appearance, Jim Spellman of CNN. Jim, welcome to Trisha's True Crime Radio. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, Trisha. It's great to be here.
Now, Jim, from day one, you have been on this story. And we'll talk about the victims here in a little bit because their stories are so tragic and so compelling. And so many of their stories, well, all of them have just torn our hearts apart. But what I like to do on this show is delve into the mind of the criminal. It's not to excuse them. It's not to pander to them. It's not to say, hey, I want to give you a hug and make it all better. I think it's important to understand why these things happen. And I think it's very important to study somebody like James Holmes. Now, what have we learned about him that gives us a better picture of what led up to James's attack and spree killing that night last summer? What do we know about James Holmes?
Well, I tell you, Trisha, I think there's still so much that we need to learn. And what's really struck me is how little of an impression he left on people who lived in his apartment building, his classmates, teachers. He really seemed, for someone who was, allegedly putting together such a massive attack, seemed to leave almost no impression on anybody. And we know now that for at least a couple of weeks, he had orange hair. He probably dyed it at least two different times. You would think that somebody like that would at least get noticed a little bit more. It makes me wonder sometimes if not getting noticed is part of his psyche, part of what troubled him. But all the way back to May 10th, we heard in testimony this last week, was when he began buying supplies for this attack, when he bought two canisters of tear gas, one of which he would later use in the theater. That's 2.5 months before this attack, where he was really, you know, as they laid out in court this week, planning meticulously going through this, and yet nobody that we've heard from publicly or even really, you know, as far as rumors go, seemed to have any idea that he was putting together this attack. It's just baffling to me how somebody can leave such a little impression on people while going through such the intense planning process.
That is interesting to note, because you would think people, especially people in his apartment building, would say, yeah, he got weirder as the days went on. He became more and more paranoid, but nothing like that. Now, he moved in with his mother, didn't he? Or where did he live?
He lived in an apartment building off campus at the University of Colorado. They have a campus here that is associated with their hospital. It's not the main campus up in Boulder or even the second campus here in Denver. And it's a small, I believe, three-story apartment building, probably about four, maybe six units on each floor that are reserved for graduate students. So it's a regular apartment building in a sort of downscale neighborhood, but it's all grad students. He lived by himself there.
Okay, and mom and dad, I know dad is very well off. Did they take care of him? Did he have to work at all?
We have our no indication that he worked at all. It's a pretty intensive program that he was in, this grad school neuroscience program. And a lot of those students that are in that program, they might work on campus doing participating in experiments and things like that, but we aren't aware that he had any kind of regular job.
Okay, so I think from the beginning we've assumed that mom and dad have been the ones to take care of him. Now, let's talk about his mother.
Well, he got, just to be clear, he did get, he was receiving a scholarship that covered, I don't recall if it was 100% of his tuition, but that covered a big chunk of it. Very bright student. This is the kind of student that schools go after.
Right, so he was, so he was somebody that was, that probably the school did go after and say, hey, we want you here. But you have to think, Jim, we're talking to Jim Spellman from CNN, about James Holmes, the Aurora killer, who went to the Batman premiere that night last summer, killing 12 people, wounding 70. You have to wonder just when his true downward spiral began. This just didn't happen over a year or two. He had to be showing signs early on. Do we know of any indication earlier, like maybe high school, even junior high, of him having trouble?
You know, we really don't. I mean, you get this picture of a smart kid, a kid very interested in science, and maybe not the most social kid ever, but we haven't heard any kind of reports of bullying. CNN, we've gone and tracked down classmates. He's from Southern California. He went to a camp. We went and spoke to people there, everybody that knew him here on campus. And he really just seemed like a normal kid. I mean, it's almost a cliche to say that, but I expected in the month after the shooting, as everybody delved into reporting on this, to find more of a dark background or something, and we just haven't found that. And I think that in one respect, that's what made it possible for him to put this, you know, elaborate plan together. And we heard evidence of just how elaborate this was. He mail ordered over 6,000 rounds of ammunition that was delivered in his apartment, yet it apparently didn't set off any alarm bells for anybody around him.
He mail ordered 6,000 rounds of ammunition, and they just
stunning, isn't it?
They just delivered it to him. Here you go, with a cherry on top.
Yeah, I knew before this story that you could mail order ammunition and a number of other things, but I had no idea that you could mail order this volume of ammunition and not set off any kind of alarm bell. You can even legally mail order purchase the tear gas that he used in the theater. None of that apparently set off any kind of, he didn't break any laws apparently doing it, but I just think it's interesting that he did not have the kind of circle of friends or even acquaintances that would notice that who was ordering 6,000 rounds of ammunition. Somebody would certainly notice if I was getting that amount of ammunition mail ordered to me.
Exactly. And so obviously there's no federal law that states if somebody orders tear gas and ammunition that they have to be, you know, at least put on a list or no, a local, you know, authorities notified. And I'm not even suggesting that should be, but I would think with at least 6,000, you know, maybe there's got to be a limit here. You know, if you order 6,000 bullets, you're going to get a call from the cops. That just seems bizarre. But anyway, so how long ago did he order these things?
May 10th, about 2.5 months before the shooting, was when he ordered the first thing. That was the tear gas. And then he went on step by step over the course of the coming month and a half or so. He bought the long gun, the AR-15, the shotgun, two handguns, numerous magazines for the gun. He bought the ballistic armor that he was wearing, helmet, gas mask. He bought all of this as well as a lot of supplies for the bombs that he made, rigging up his apartment building. We learned a lot of detail about that before he
Tell us about
theater.
It. Tell us
yeah,
about
well,
those details.
Sure. So he had rigged up his apartment, and this is another thing I find baffling that nobody else in the apartment building would notice this, but he soaked his carpet in oil and gasoline. He had many of these small, they're called fireworks shells, and they're about an 8-10-inch round ball that are full of black powder and some other sort of chemical in it. It's a small bomb, essentially. He had made homemade napalm, which is actually apparently very simple to make, and he had filled jars with this napalm, essentially like it's with the consistency like a jelly, full of bullets that had black powder on top of it attached to detonators, multiple of these jars. Basically, they were rigged to blow up and set the whole fire, the whole apartment on fire. Three systems to make this go off. The first was fishing wire connected from the doorknob to a thermos full of one chemical that when the door was opened, it would pour over into a frying pan full of another chemical. I'm not going to say the names of these chemicals. I don't want to give anybody
idea. No, absolutely.
And it would essentially create a small explosion and a lot of sparks that would set off the gasoline in the carpet and the rest of the explosives. The second system, wait to hear this, Tricia, the second system is a series of detonators that are used with model rockets that you could buy like at a hobby shop kind of place, rigged to a remote control. He took the remote control itself, and he put it outside of his apartment next to a dumpster. He put a CD with 40 minutes of silence and then really loud music into a boombox, put the boombox in a trash bag. Next to it, he put a toy remote control car, and the remote control, not for the car, but for the explosives, right upstairs in his apartment. The idea, police said, is that the music would go off in the boombox. That would attract somebody to walk over, and they would see the cool remote control car with the remote control next to it. They would pick up the remote
control. They'd pick it up.
Try to play with the car, and it would set off the apartment. Now, very interestingly, they never found that remote control car or the remote control. They did find the boombox. A neighbor came by, found it playing, and took it home. And they found that boombox with police said with James Holmes' print on it. But for the about 2 days that bomb squad people tried to dismantle this apartment, they knew that out there somewhere was this remote control. And if it came within about 200 meters of the apartment building and the button would switch, it could detonate this entire thing. James Holmes, according to testimony by police officers, told police all of this right after they arrested him at the theater. Somehow it was like he changed his mind, he chickened out, we don't know what. But he almost immediately ran over all of these details with them. So they did have a leg up when they showed up at the apartment building. But try to picture somebody in a small student apartment building going through all of this for weeks, acquiring the stuff, putting this together. Pretty incredible to visualize.
Well, it is. And I would think with the oil on the carpets and all kinds of things that it would smell in addition to, you know, putting this all together. Let me get back to the remote control car. So were police operating on the theory that somebody had taken the car not realizing what it was and just took it. And so somebody could be playing with it, come within 200 yards of the thing and blow everybody up. Now that's pretty scary. That's evil. That is really.
And he told police the reason he had rigged it up this way and not with just a timer was he had hoped initially, he also had music set to go off on a timer essentially in his apartment. And his hope was that a neighbor would call and complain about the noise. Police would show up and they would open the door and it would set off the explosion and it would kill or injure the police officer that responded, which he speculated would draw a huge response whenever an officer is involved and injured. It would cause a huge response so that there would be less police to respond to his attack on the movie theater.
Oh, my God. He did really think this out. I mean, it's one thing to plan. This thing was meticulous. He obviously is a genius, but what triggered this? What triggered this need to be noticed in such a horrific, bloody way? Do we have any indication, Jim Spellman from CNN, any indication what caused this obviously bright young man to take this turn in his life?
We know about almost exactly 1 month in early June, about a month after he buys the first tear gas canisters, he has trouble with some exams. Now, there's a lot of rules about confidentiality with students and with medical records that made it, and there's a gag order on this whole case, so it's made it difficult to really complete this part of the picture. But we know that he had some trouble with some exams in this very intense program and that he chose to withdraw from school. So we know that, and all of that lines up with about when he buys the first gun, which to me I think buying the actual gun is a kind of a big amplification of his preparations. Before that, he's buying ballistic armor, he's buying chemicals, and he's buying the tear gas. Then he really kind of makes the next leap and buys guns. So all of that happens right about when he drops out of school after having trouble with his exams. But you know, Tricia, a lot of people, myself included, you might fail a class in college or something like that, and it doesn't set this off. So we need to know a lot more about what was going on with him to be able to answer those kinds of questions, I think. And unfortunately, I feel like in these cases, you never really get a satisfactory answer to exactly why somebody, you know, would do this. But I'm dying to know. I mean, we'll find out a lot more about this if, as we expect, the defense chooses to use an essentially what we call an insanity defense. If they choose to do that, then a lot of this mental health information will become ultimately public and will be known to the other side prosecutors. Right now it's all sealed. There's a gag order, so we haven't been able to fill that part in.
Let's talk about James Holmes' mother for a moment. We have learned a lot about Nancy. I have read, and I would like you, Jim Spellman of CNN, to confirm this for me or tell me what is the truth. I have read that she was almost a doomsdayer type person, collecting guns, getting ready for the end. Is that true?
I just want to be sure, Tricia, that we're talking about the same thing, James Holmes' mother and not the mother of the shooter in Connecticut.
No, we're talking about James Holmes' mother. I apologize. You know what? I apologize. I got them. I'm sorry. I got them confused. You're right. You're right. I got them confused with a Connecticut mother. You know what? That's so sad, Jim. There are so many of these cases. I cannot keep them straight. What do we know about this? It was James Holmes' mother that reportedly said, if I remember correctly, you got the right person. And then later she said, I wasn't talking about my son. Is that correct?
I think that was it. Yes.
Yeah.
Initially, I think she had seen some early press reports. The family lives in Southern California. As best that I can tell, I've only seen them at one of the hearings. That was last month. They showed up, and I spoke to them briefly, and they didn't want to comment. They just referred me to their attorney, and their attorney hadn't made a statement. But I think partly because they're off in Southern California near San Diego, not here. They haven't
They
don't get as much of the scrutiny from the press that's here covering covering this, but you know, they weren't you know, picture a grad student, not undergrad, but a grad student living, you know, 1,500 miles away. I don't know what kind of contact they have, but we haven't gotten any indication that they saw him in person very often, perhaps holidays or something like that. So they were probably, I mean, I'm speculating here, but, you know, possibly as in the dark as the rest of us, and apparently as his, you know, people in close proximity to him about what was going on in those last months.
I've seen pictures of him, and I'm sure you have, of James Holmes, and when he, I think it might have been a ninth grade science fair, or it was in school. What a cute kid. I mean, he looks so normal and smart. It's just, we really don't know what triggered this. He had to. He had to have been having some sort of mental issue a long time ago, don't you think?
I think so. Now, and a lot of attention has been paid to a psychiatrist at the university here. Her name is Dr. Lynn Senden.
Yes.
And now, again, because of the gag order and privacy rules of, you know, doctor-patient confidentiality, we haven't gotten that whole picture there. And I think that some people in the press have kind of painted a relationship where Holmes and Fenton have some sort of long, ongoing, you know, relationship, and picture him sitting on the couch kind of baring his soul to her like in a movie or something. But the only thing that we've heard direct evidence about is that they met one time when he told the school he was dropping out. And that's as a matter of course, the school recommends anybody who dropped out unexpectedly to see somebody in their mental health department. Now, they may have met before that. We don't know. But the only thing we know via evidence is that they got together that one time. So we don't know what kind of relationship they had. We don't know what he told her. But clearly, in his mind, she was a significant person. There was a significant relationship because the shooting happened early on a Friday. It was a midnight showing, so about 38 minutes after midnight on a Friday morning is when the shooting began. That Thursday, he mailed a notebook of some sort that had in it burnt currency that was addressed to Dr. Fenton and mailed to the university. Now, almost immediately after he was arrested and was given a public defender, he told the public defender he had mailed this.
Mm-hmm.
The public defender went to the university and said, this man sent a notebook to a psychiatrist. It's privileged material. We want you to give it immediately to us. Now, it's not that simple. The bomb squad went over it and things like that. But we don't know what's in it. And at this point, the court has it. It's still sealed. Nobody has looked at it since it was sealed after that, those first hours in the mailroom where it was found. But
so,
clearly, he was trying to communicate with her. I mean, this was a significant relationship to him anyway.
This burnt money, now that's interesting. That to me, screams of somebody who's delusional, like trying to send some sort of message. We don't have any idea what that meant.
No.
Oh,
and we don't know what's written in the notebook. We don't know if when the notebook was written, if it was old material or if it was something he wrote specifically to send to her. We just don't know. You know, there's two things I would really like to talk about, Tricia. One is the photograph that he took of himself. Because if you want a look into, if you want to look into what was going on, you know, in his mind, I think what police say they found on his iPhone is really significant. Because you go back to the weeks leading up to the attack, and first of all, there are photographs on his phone apparently he took in the theater, casing the theater, certain hallways, exterior doors, how the doors operate, the kind of things that information that you would want if you were putting together an attack that you could get.
Right.
So on one hand, you see this a meticulous mind at work, going, visiting, he goes and photographs the exterior at night, you know, under similar lighting conditions. And he's going, you know, through this work. It was definitely no kind of spur-of-the-moment thing. The shooting happened, I believe, on the 20th. On the 7th of July, he purchased a ticket online. So this was a long, plotted-out thing. But the really shocking – so that sort of shows one part of his mind, perhaps, you know, the meticulous, scientific sort of part of his mind. But then the other side, he's taking photographs of himself with in this full body armor with the AR-15, bright mm-hmm. orange hair. Then you see a series of photographs taken just hours before the attack. I've never seen anything like this. And you've probably only seen the courtroom sketches of the photographs.
That's all I've seen.
They don't quite do them justice. They haven't released the photographs. Black contact lenses that render his full eyeballs black.
What? His black? Really? Oh,
yes.
God.
Very, very creepy. In one, he's holding the handgun right mm-hmm. there under his chin. Imagine, you know, holding your iPhone out at arm's length and taking a photograph of yourself. That kind of intimate picture. In another, you see his bomb-making array. In another, you see his bed with all of his gear laid out. This is about 6:30, about half 6 hours before he goes to the theater, all of his stuff meticulously laid out. Mm-hmm. And then you see a series, one where he's holding one of the bombs with this huge grin, and a couple other similar ones from this series with the black contact lenses, orange hair, or wearing a skull cap covering his orange hair. That's what the police say he wore into the theater to cover up his orange hair before the shooting. But throughout those, you see this, and Tricia, when they showed these in court, they put them on a sort of plasma screen TV. For only a couple of times through all these hearings I've been to, you can see James Holmes smiling and being completely engaged in this. And this enraged family members. I mean,
can you imagine?
All they do, there's some of the family members follow the proceedings. Some cry every time. Mm-hmm. A couple of them do not take their eyes off of James Holmes. They don't watch the attorneys. They don't watch the evidence. They watch nothing but James Holmes. Mm-hmm. And I was watching James Holmes smiling, watching the photographs, and then watching these family members' reaction. It was so intense. I mean, I can't imagine what it would be like to look at. Not only to sit and watch this man that killed or injured your loved one, but for you, but to see him enjoying so much, seeing these pictures of him sort of fetishizing his guns, you know, with his orange hair, these weird contacts, and whatever was going on in his head when he took the pictures and put this together, him sort of reliving it. You know,
I was
going
to say,
it's
like the courtroom is letting him relive this, what to him was a great moment, apparently. Oh, my God. So was that when one of the family members told him to rot in hell? Was it right after that, or when did that happen?
That was a little later. So that was on Wednesday, and then the court took Thursday off while the judge ruled, and then they came back Friday to have their decision and go forward. And the emotion in the court was so intense. And I'm a little surprised that we didn't see more of this. Throughout the week. I mean, the family members have embraced. The district attorney's office has gone over everything with them and let them know what they could expect when they were in court, mm-hmm. what kind of evidence they would see. You know, we heard a 911 call, 27-second 911 call. You heard 30 shots in the background.
Oh, my God.
They have embraced for that. Mm-hmm. But I think at the end, knowing that Holmes was walking off back to his jail cell, that, you know, essentially the rest of this guy's life is going to be court proceedings and jail and, you know, possibly a death penalty. But for them, they're going through this anguish every day, mm-hmm. you know. And when that man, his name is Steve Hernandez, his daughter Rebecca Wingo was murdered in Cuba. When he yelled, rotten hell home, you had to feel that in a way he was speaking for, you know,
everybody
in that courtroom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's just it. You can only try and put yourself in their position, but I don't think any of us can really feel the deep down grief that they are feeling. And to know that this guy is getting enjoyment, he gets to enjoy something. And you're right, his life, at least for the next 20 years, is going to be probably back and forth at courtrooms, and he'll be able to relive and enjoy, and their loved ones are dead at the hands of this man. You're absolutely right, Jim. I don't know why more people didn't get up and yell and scream at him, but they don't, you know, I'm assuming they don't want to disrupt the courtroom, and they don't want to see him have any more of an advantage than he already has. We're talking with Jim Spellman from CNN about James Holmes. And what's the latest in the court now? What happens next?
Well, the next thing that will happen is sort of a side issue. the defense spent a lot of time about leaks to the news media about that notebook that we talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And they're subpoenaing a reporter at FoxNews.com. But in February, they plan on bringing this reporter from New York here to Colorado. Now, I got to tell you, I think it's a real long shot that, A, they're going to go through it and get her here. And if she does show up, she'll be surrounded by News Corp, attorneys, as
right.
would CNN attorneys or anybody else. I'm not really sure why they're so hell-bent on figuring out this leak. They had a whole day-long hearing where they put up every cop, bomb, squad person that dealt with this notebook and tried to get them to say who leaked the press. So that's kind of a side issue at this point.
Mm-hmm.
In March...
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry. Continue.
Yeah. Well, in March he'll be arraigned, and he'll have to enter a plea. The judge is letting all of this go really slow because he knows that he does not want anything there for there to be a potential appeal. So he's really going slow with it at this point.
Well, that's good. We definitely want him to be very, very careful. So he has a court date coming up. And do we know when the trial is going to be? Do we have any idea?
We don't. And between. At some point, perhaps between now and March when the arraignment is, it's almost positive they're going to deal with the issue of competency, which is, just to be clear, competency is whether the defendant is mentally capable of assisting in his own defense and understands the proceedings at this point. Nothing to do with whether he was, quote, sane during the shooting, but now, you call the Jared Loughner case and the Gabby Gifford shooting and the other people at that Safeway in Arizona,
mm-hmm.
they found him not competent to stand
right.
trial. And then he went to a mental facility, came back, and pled. So
right.
at some point, they'll doubtlessly bring up competency that could
mm-hmm.
delay it even further. But, I would say we're looking at probably a year and a half before there's
oh.
any kind of trial. That's just an estimate.
Those poor families. Now, real briefly, and then I know you have to go, Jim. I appreciate you spending this much time with us. I'm sorry. Do you need to run?
Well, I was going to say, Trisha, I'd love to stay a little longer, and if we could, and maybe talk a little bit about the theater that night. And,
oh, let's do. I would love you to stay. Let's talk about the theater that night. Tell us what you know.
Well, we got a much more fleshed out picture of what exactly happened in that theater.
Mm-hmm.
So we know through, this is all, allegations via testimony that we heard this last week in preliminary hearing. So James Holmes on the 7th of July goes on Fandango, buys a ticket for the premiere of Batman movie. So he bought a ticket for a showing that was going to be in theater number 8 in this multiplex.
Mm-hmm.
He shows up, he's wearing regular street clothes, unbuttoned white button-up shirt, over a dress shirt. He's got a black skull cap on, covering his orange hair. He goes in, he uses the automated machine that scans your phone and gives you a ticket. He kills a little time in the concession stand. We saw all of this from surveillance cameras. And then he doesn't go into Theater 8, and we're unclear why he didn't go into Theater 8, but I know a lot of the people who went to movies that night in Theater 8 are wondering why they were spared this attack,
mm-hmm.
and
right.
people in Theater 9 got it. So he didn't go into Theater 8. He went into Theater 9, which had a movie
uh-huh.
that started, I think, a few minutes earlier or later than the other
okay.
show. Remember, this is one of these things, after midnight, it's the premiere, that's when they can first show the movie. So
right.
it's all after midnight. So he shows up, he goes in, he sits down near the front of the theater. A man who is sitting there next to him sees him getting up, and he recalled seeing orange hair sticking out from under his skull cap and noted that why was somebody wearing essentially a ski cap in July,
mm-hmm.
the hottest summer in Colorado history.
Makes sense,
so that,
right?
That was notably it. So the guy gets up. He witnesses this man, we now know James Holmes, gets up with a telephone call. Now, in an earlier hearing, we heard testimony that 9 minutes before the shooting happened that he phoned the university to
mm-hmm.
a number that was an after-hours number that potentially would be a number you would call if you were trying to reach the psychiatrist, Dr. Fenton.
Oh, wow.
9 minutes before the shooting.
So he leaves
via an emergency exit door up near the screen at the front of the theater. He's taken these little, two picture of these metal clips that they sell to go on a picnic table to stop the wind from blowing the tablecloth around.
Mm-hmm.
He had taken one of these metal clips, covered it in duct tape to make it bigger. He already had that with him, and he used that to prop the door open, to keep the door from closing.
Okay, that's what he used. All right.
He stepped outside to his car. Now, we didn't hear direct testimony about this, and there are no surveillance cameras back there. But his car is there, and presumably he then goes and puts on all of his gear. Meanwhile, the movie begins. There's an ad, there's preview, and he goes out and puts on this whole set of ballistic gear, including helmet, gas mask, and neck protector, this whole thing. And he goes in with three weapons, handgun, shotgun, and the AR-15 assault rifle. He goes into the theater and he begins shooting. He goes through, as best you can piece it together, six shotgun shells that the gun would hold. They drop the shotgun by the front of the screen. Then he starts with the long gun, and he's shooting. And then walking back towards the end of the theater. Then the gun jams with the assault rifle, and he starts using the handgun. But he doesn't empty the magazine in the handgun, and he has many more magazines for both the assault rifle and the handgun. And he only fired 76 shots. He shot 58 people that were wounded and another 12 that were murdered. Mm-hmm. 70 people, and he only shot 76 shots. A lot of these bullets went through one person.
Wow. That's pretty amazing, actually.
But a big question that a lot of us in court had was, as best you can tell, he almost voluntarily stopped. And he turned around, and he walked out of the theater, and he walked to his car. He put the handgun that had a green laser sight on it on the roof of the car, and he stood there with his hands on the roof, one on either side of the handgun. Now, for 1 hour in Aurora, Colorado, at between midnight and 1 o'clock, the night shift and the swing shift overlap for police officers. So that is the hour of the day when there are the most amount of cops on the street. And you can see, literally, from the theater, you can see a police station.
Mm-hmm.
So within 90 seconds, the first officers were there. And in less than 5 minutes, over 100 officers were on site.
Mm-hmm.
So the first officer comes around the back of the theater, and he sees James Holmes standing there, and at first he thinks that he's another police officer.
Right.
He's wearing all of his tactics.
All the gear.
All the gear. And it's not until he realizes that everyone else is trying to get out. There's people running past him. There's tear gas coming out of the door that he realizes that this is potentially a suspect.
Mm-hmm.
So he arrests him. And almost immediately, Holmes says, "There's bombs in my apartment." They strip him out of his gear. They get him down to his underwear so they can search him through all his ballistic gear. And then they end up arresting him and taking him away. Meanwhile, there's blood on the sidewalk. That was how the police officer made it to the back of the theater. He followed a trail of blood from people running out of the theater. And picture this, Trisha. The first police officer who walks into the theater, all he has is his Glock sidearm, and he's just seen a guy wearing military-style stuff with a hot with mm-hmm. There's an assault rifle. He drops the assault rifle right at the door of the theater. He walks into a scene. The movie is still playing, right? And the sound from the movie is still there, projecting through the tear gas smoke from the canister of tear gas Holmes had thrown into it. He's crunching on shell casing and popcorn and blood that is pooling on the ground. There are people moaning. There's cell phones going off. And an alarm is going from the emergency exit door.
Oh my God!
And I bring that up because for as much attention as police officers get in many realms, and a lot of times, especially if you look back, it's easy to say, "Oh, someone should have done that or should have done this." But boy, I tell you, trying to put yourself in that officer's shoes, walking in there, not knowing if there was another shooter, what you were coming up against, into that scene. Unbelievable. As soon as they cleared the theater, these police officers started putting people in the back of their cars and driving them to the theater. The one officer, the first one on the scene that arrested James Holmes, testified he made four runs to the hospital with badly wounded people. By the end, there was so much blood in the back of his cruiser, he could hear it sloshing around if he went to the corners. He held, and just one more thing about this. So this officer, the first guy, the guy who cuffed and arrested James Holmes, he's driving. This is what brought everything back to the reality of what goes on in these cases, beyond the sort of legal issues and evidence and whatever else. He had a man whose wife Ashley Mosier is shot in the head and somewhere in the torso. He's on his lap with a friend, another friend that they were dealing with in the car. They start flying down the road. It's 1 a.m, streets are wide open. They're going 80 miles an hour down the road to the hospital. He realizes that his 6-year-old daughter is not in the car with him. He thought she was. 80 miles an hour flying down the road. He's trying to get out of the car. The police officer, who's just arrested James Holmes and is driving them, is reaching across and holding him down, holding him from getting out of the car so that they can get to the theater. His six-year-old daughter was shot 4 times by James Holmes. He didn't know it, but she had already died back in
My God.
But
dear God.
The horror, you know, of the reality of what goes on here and the contrast between these cops and firefighters that showed and other theater goers who were helping each other, the contrast between their actions and what James Holmes, you know, apparently chose to use his intelligence and everything for, was in such stark contrast. And you heard all the testimony of what went on there in the theater.
You just painted such a horrific picture, Jim Spellman from CNN, of that night. I'm just stunned. I'm speechless. I can't imagine the living hell that these people were going through. And the way you have described it, Jim, makes me think, and tell me if you think this, James Holmes gets in there, he starts shooting, it's not what he thought. It's not as, I don't know, enjoyable or whatever, and that's why he stopped. And that's why he went out. Did he have a crisis of conscience after he did all of this horrible, you know, all of these horrible murders? Did his conscience just get to him finally and say, enough? Was the call to the university to try and talk, I'm assuming we can make a logical assumption that perhaps it was to the psychiatrist that he had been seeing, trying to get in touch with her. Could it have been, help me, stop me? I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know either. And the prosecution clearly said if his gun didn't jam, that he would have kept shooting.
Okay.
Now they said that, and I can't really speculate. But to just speak a little bit about the evidence, he had a 100-round, I'm not getting too technical, 100-round drum magazine for the AR-15. And these really high-capacity magazines are notoriously not good. They jam a lot. They're not reliable. But there were hundreds of rounds in the theater inside of prepared magazines, more regular-sized 30- and 40-round magazines.
Mm-hmm.
And I've fired weapons very similar to that before, and you can clear a jam in that very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Given the amount of preparation he went through, you know, I can't imagine that he didn't practice clearing jams in the weapon. And there were still rounds in the handgun that the last weapon he was firing, the only weapon he still had with him when he went out to the car. So I don't know. I mean, another thing though to consider though is before we perhaps get too much in our head that he had a crisis of conscience, he could have walked out, and part of his plan could have been, I'm going to walk out and shoot it out with the cops.
Right.
Perhaps, you know, death by suicide by cop, or that was just part of his plan, and maybe he just, you know, chickened out, for lack of a better word.
Yeah,
I don't know. I don't know what was going on, but I think something happened that made him stop shooting in that meter. And I mean, there were hundreds more people he could have presumably shot. You know,
You have to wonder too, Jim, about the first responders. How are they going to deal with this? What you described sounds like something that they would put in a Hollywood movie that you would never see in real life because it is too horrific. You know, to be walking and crunching and sliding in blood when you first get there, and people are laying there moaning and trying to hold a man in your police car going 80 miles an hour in so much blood in the back seat that it's sloshing, trying to hold him from jumping out to get to his daughter who's already dead, which he didn't know at the time. All of these things that you have described, it's almost too much to grasp as reality. It's a movie. It's a horror movie.
And I saw police officer after police officer, and these are, you know, I mean, this is not their first rodeo, right? These are seasoned cops, and you know that they put their best people as lead detectives on these stories. I mean, on these stories, on these cases, and these were mostly the people that we heard from, as well as those men who showed up in the early moment that confronted him face to face. And to a one, all of them, to some degree, broke down. I mean, some of them had to take a break. These are cops. These are not witnesses.
And we know they're not tough guys. They are. They're tough.
I saw, Tricia, there were two coroners who did the autopsy. And one of the coroners broke down. I mean, if anybody's ever met coroners, I mean, look, these people have an unusual job.
Yeah.
They're not easily disturbed by things they see. And it was the woman, the coroner, who did the autopsy on the six-year-old.
Oh, my God.
To Mosier Sullivan. And she paused and had to compose herself during that. Yeah, the horror that they went through wasn't just at the theater. I mean, it really just impacted everybody. 1,000 law enforcement officers have been working with Kate. And I have to imagine that every one of them, as well as, you know, really everyone in this community, are just shocked by the senselessness of the brutality of the attack.
Well, exactly. And those police officers go home, and their families and spouses and children, you know, have to deal with whatever they're dealing with. And so the ripple effect continues. But ripple effect just sounds so light compared to what it really is. And it has really affected the whole community. Honestly, Jim, the way you describe that, I picture it, and I'm not going to be able to go to sleep tonight. I'm just going to keep closing my eyes and seeing that. Is there help for the first responders in Colorado? Do you know?
You know, I don't know specifically, but I'm sure they must have some sort of help within their departments for, you know, PTSD, essentially, from something like this.
I think you're going to see a lot of that later on, because you can't go through something like that and be a human being and not have it change you in some way. So, and then you can just talk about the families and what the living hell they're going through, and then you have survivor's guilt. It just goes on, and the people that were in the theater that lived and who witnessed all of this. It's beyond a horror story. I don't think there's a word created yet to describe how truly awful and evil all of this is. They will go for the death penalty, don't you think, in this case?
I think a lot of that. I'm not as certain of that as I think some other people are. I think there's a brand new district attorney. The previous one was term limited, and there's election and everything. And the new district attorney was sworn in. Actually, in the middle of this preliminary hearing on Monday evening, and so he doesn't have a track record, so we don't know. The death penalty in Colorado is used very sparingly.
When was the last time? Do you know? Do you know when the last time someone was put to death?
Yeah, it was within the last couple of years, and it was a crime that happened before I moved here, so I'm not super up on it. But I think it's only a handful of times the death penalty has been used, you know, since the late 70s or so. But it's not a common. It's certainly nothing like you know, Texas, Virginia, or other
Florida
states. Yeah, right. Florida. Yeah. So I'm not sure it's certain. Amongst family members, there's definitely not a consensus about it. I haven't spoken to everybody, but I haven't gotten a real fervor from them for the death penalty. I think most of them that I've spoken to anyway would be content if he's just locked up, you know,
right,
for the rest of his life.
Exactly. Yeah, I don't know what it would do for them to put him to death, because first of all, it would take 20 years to do, and they'd have to hear about it constantly, and obviously he's going to be locked up somewhere for life. There is no way you can ever let this beast out, no matter what. I don't care if he's sick. I don't care if he's, you know, crazy, mentally ill. He cannot be let out into society again, no matter what. Jim, is there anything else you'd like to add? You know, everyone is going to listen to this, and throughout the week people will download it because it's it's so fascinating, and the word of mouth will get around quickly about what you've been talking about and the picture you have painted for us. Is there anything else that you would like to tell us that maybe, since we're not there, we don't really know?
Well, not really. I think that we've covered most everything, but I do want to just emphasize again. I went over it pretty clearly, but I just want to emphasize again the first responders' response. And I think we talk a lot about first responders, but boy, in this case, more than any other that I've covered, you really saw on display not only their bravery and that sort of thing, but really their intelligence, that they were able to have this man under arrest and the theater cleared, and that they were driving these people, without even thinking, almost by instinct. They knew that there was this huge traffic jam there, and that they weren't going to get enough ambulances with this many people, that they were able to spring into that kind of action. And as someone who interviews cops a lot, and sometimes it's an adversarial relationship when you're trying to get information from them or things like that, boy, I was just floored by hearing this description of everything they went through. And so as much as the horror will stay with us of this kind of thing, I do get a little bit of peace knowing that these guys are out there. I mean, it's pretty amazing.
It has given you the confidence to know that they know what they're doing. Well, this is what they train for their whole career, and they pray they never have to deal with anything this massive. But you're right. I mean, if we had to walk into something like that, I know I would just fall apart. I'd be no use to anybody. And so we are, I'm sure you're very grateful for them, and I just hope and pray that they're okay too. I want them to be okay too. So you'll keep us up to date though, right, Jim? You're gonna be right on top of this, and you'll come back perhaps in the summertime. We'll have another chat, and we'll talk about more of what you've learned. How's that?
I look forward to it. Thanks, Georgia.
Jim Spellman of CNN. Jim, I can't thank you enough. This has been one of the most compelling, amazing shows, and that's all thanks to you, my dear. Thank you, and you take care, and we'll talk to you soon, okay?
All right, thanks. So long.
Bye-bye. Oh, Jim Spellman, what a great guy. I will never, ever be able, for a long time, to close my eyes. I close my eyes now. That's all I can see. I can just picture that cop walking down the aisle, crunching popcorn and shells and blood and the moaning and the tear gas and the movie going and the alarm. It does sound like, though, it really does sound like that this guy had a crisis of conscience. He started shooting, is my guess, and it realized that what he was doing was real, maybe. It was the real thing. And he stopped. And he went out and he put his hands on his roof of his car with the gun in between his hands and waited for the cops to come arrest him. And then James Holmes told them all about the bomb and the explosives and everything that was going on in his apartment. He did. He changed his mind. That doesn't make him any... Certainly, he doesn't get any points for that. He's still a beast who needs to be put away. But I think he changed his mind. I think he saw that this was real and the nightmare that he created, and he stopped. That's just my opinion. Kimster, are you there? Kimster? Let me see. Kimster. There. Oh. Hold on, you're on hold for some reason. Okay, which one are you? I have two phones here with you on it. I've got them both on.
Well, we need to do a sound check because I'm not sure if I'm sounding good enough. Do you hear me okay right now?
You sound great. Yeah, you sound fine.
Okay. All right, well, my audio isn't doing well, so I'm glad to know that my vocals are fine. So if
your
I
vocals?
Say, huh, you'll know why.
I'll know why. Wasn't that just an amazing interview?
Yes, it was.
I didn't know. I thought I knew the scene. I thought I knew what happened. I thought I knew all of this. And after tonight, I realized I didn't know anything. And the picture that Jim Spellman from CNN painted of when they showed these pictures that James Holmes took of himself with the black contact lenses and smiling, oh, it is beyond anything that I can even begin to comprehend. Okay, Kimster, we're going to change topics now because I need to kind of bring it up here before I crawl into a fetal position and never get out of it and just stay there. Kimster,
I understand.
You sent me some very interesting stats today, and I'm very proud of you and proud of our Web Sleuths members. Tell me about it.
Well, I have been following our featured cold cases each week, and it just seemed to me like there were more people going to the threads than normal, because mm-hmm. back when I first started, you know, we'd see maybe 10 or 15 more people visiting the threads of the cold cases, and then all of a sudden it seemed like they were just ballooning. So I've been keeping stats, and last week's featured cold case, when we got started, there were 24 members who had looked at the thread in the last year. At the end, which was earlier this morning, there were 238 Web Sleuths members, and that does not count our guests.
Our guests are usually 3 to 4 times higher than our members. So, wow, Kim, that is great. I'm glad to see that people are looking at these cases that you're talking about, because that's how they get solved. And I hope everybody tells all their friends to go on Web Sleuths and take a look, because you never know when you might be the one that has that little piece of evidence that just might make all the difference in the world. And how about it, Kimster? It's time for the Web Sleuths Hot Cold Case. What do we have this week?
Well, first of all, I want to make something perfectly clear around here, Tricia.
Okay.
My new Web Sleuths avatar is not a UFO pooping hearts.
Oh, come on. I thought that's exactly what it was. What are you talking about? What?
Well, I just want to say that Nurse Beanie needs some new glasses, because it's obviously a nice and kind alien beaming down love, a sweet alien with a mean ray gun.
Well, let me tell you, Kimster, it looks like an alien spaceship pooping hearts. But now that you've explained it, I understand. It's a love thing. It's full of love. And poops look shaped like hearts. That's all I can say. Kimster, it is a cute avatar, though. I love it. It's very good.
Well,
okay, it's time for the Web Sleuths Hot Cold Case. Kimster, take it away.
Do, 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 do.
Love the horn. Love the horn.
Tricia, Southern Oregon is absolutely gorgeous year-round. In fact, one of my favorite places I've ever been is Jacksonville, Oregon. It's an old mining town that's rich in history and fun things to see and do. And when you're there, you can imagine a world that isn't anything but safe and tranquil. But as we know, even the most beautiful places on earth can be ruined by tragedy. Jeremy Bright went missing in Myrtle Beach, Oregon on August 14, 1986, during the time of the Coos County Fair. Jeremy was 14 years old and looking forward to high school. He was last seen wearing a black windbreaker jacket and black Nike shoes with red shoelaces. His sister is a member of WebSleuths.com, and she wants your help to help find him. There's been a few different rumors about Jeremy's disappearance. One is that he joined the carnival because the fair had just been going on. Mm-hmm. Another is that he accidentally overdosed at a party. And another that he was accidentally shot at a swimming hole and his body was taken to a cabin to try and nurse him back to health. But instead, he died and was buried near the cabin. Tricia, how do all these rumors get started?
Boy, I don't know, but they come up with some doozies, don't they?
I know. All the cases have all these strange rumors, and I wouldn't even be surprised if these rumors have nothing to do with this disappearance, but
mm-hmm.
I do need to tell you guys what they are. Jeremy's sister has posted about a primary person of interest who has since died in prison. If he was responsible, maybe he told someone what happened, and that information could lead to finding Jeremy. If you're listening and you know something, please contact law enforcement. It's been 25 years and the family is still suffering. They need to bury Jeremy and start their grieving process. Please go to Jeremy's thread and add your thoughts on this case. Just go to www.websleuths.com. In the upper right-hand corner, you'll see a picture of Jeremy Bright along with the link to the thread. But only if you're a member of websleuths.com. So please join today. And Tricia, how much does it cost to join?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked. It's absolutely free. We just need an email address. We don't need your corneas. We don't need your blood type. We just need an email address. And that is it. You have to be 13 or older. And you are set and ready to rock, Kimster.
Yes, thank you very much. And everybody, thank you so much for visiting that thread. Let's break the goal from last week. You know, now it's, what do they say? It's now the bar. We have to go over the bar.
Yes,
so
we're raising the bar. Yes, we're raising the bar.
We had 238 users on the last one. Let's go to 250 for next week.
I think that's easy to do. Kimster, thank you so very much. And my friends, that is it for another edition of Trisha's True Crime Radio, where we discuss incredible true crime events like we did tonight with Jim Spellman. I'm telling you, that was, I'm going to have to listen to this show again because that was just some amazing. He is such a great reporter, and he tells the truth, and there's no, I mean, he tells something that's dramatic enough, and he just gives it in a factual yet very descriptive way. I love the guy. I hope he'll come on the show more and more, and I know he's a fan of Web Sleuths as well. And Trisha's True Crime Radio is brought to you by Canines with a Cause, where they rescue animals from death row and then give them to returning veterans to help them adjust, especially those with post-traumatic stress that are coming home. Visit their website, Canines with a Cause, that's Canines with a Cause .com. Trisha's True Crime Radio, the opinions expressed on this show are those of the guests and the hosts, and of course, I take no responsibility for them whatsoever. And do keep in mind that Trisha's True Crime Radio is its own separate little entity. It's my own little world, people, and we are not in any way, shape, or form connected with websleuths.com, LLC, or formsforjustice.org. We'll see you next week. It's Trisha's True Crime Radio, where we discuss current events. And we always do it with common sense. Take care. Bye-bye.